Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for today's interview with Peter Kaufman, Program Manager in Strategic Initiatives and Resource Development at MIT Open Learning. His book, The New Enlightenment and the Fight to Free Knowledge, is out this year with Seven Stories Press. I know when I'm beat. You, my listeners, will be used by now to my five-minute intros, where my view on the subject matter of the book invites you, if not entices you, into the interview of the day. I like to make a thing that's interesting to me, interesting too to others. But listeners have been beat. Peter Kaufman's own eloquence cannot be made more eloquent, and the interest Peter Kaufman generates in every line and every moment of his book, The New Enlightenment, is about as interesting as things get. So I doff my hat and give the word to Peter. Here is, as invitation and enticement, call it a trailer, here is some of what Peter writes in his book, The New Enlightenment. The forces that line up to shut down experiments in public service and educational content, often led by rights holders seeking to monetize that content before everything is available online, are strong. Years ago, they put the kibosh on an early majestic experiment at the BBC, and they have been busy before and since. Consortial efforts are required because the world's strongest vested interests, whether Elsevier, Wiley, Disney, Sony, Warner, or any of 100 others, are commercializing our knowledge, locking it away from us, exerting a powerful counterforce upon its natural trajectory into the commons. That force lasts longer than the lifetime of single human advocates, and when these nefarious and financially powerful corporations expand and merge and acquire one another, they benefit by receiving not only the assets and revenue of the companies they buy, but the accrued mandates of their institutional existences, their connections, their collective suppression strategies, the momentum behind which is considerable. When church and state working together, the church being the publisher or JSTOR of its day, neutralize or eliminate our greatest advocates and heroes, the only way we can combat their power is by aggressive and collective action. We have to launch a consortial effort to take back the public broadcasting efforts we seem to have abandoned writ large as a global society. A consortial effort to establish, produce, co-program a new web network, perhaps called Public Sphere Broadcasting, one devoted to the public weal rather than to the bottom line. We might, this means we should, therefore want to start, this means we should start right away, a new national, even international, commission of experts from science, media, technology, and the arts to explore the proper role for the university and sister knowledge institutions in our modern and broken information ecosystem. We have to start consciously collaborating with one another and producing, but immediately, for this new knowledge network. Signs of what is possible are evident everywhere. The Internet Archive, always a host and sponsor of such co-productions, is working with Wikipedia now digitizing books so that links to sources in Wikipedia link all the way through to the books themselves and render up images and text on the cited pages. This takes the Encyclopédie's vision and ambition to a whole new level. By producing for the network, we will make it happen and grow. Today, all these knowledge institutions we have are involved in education. Physical, online, public K-8, university level, high school level, advanced, you name it. But are we also in the healthcare business, the banking business, education policy, foreign policy, climate change? You bet we are. We are everywhere the Monsterverse is. Is racial discrimination our topic? Gender discrimination? Abortion? Gun laws? Tax reform? You bet they are. So listeners, you hear it for yourselves. This is the sort of flow and go, on topic and on fire, that I simply must bow to. Let's begin today's episode. Peter Kaufman and the New Enlightenment. Peter, welcome to Scholarly Communication.
Daniel, thank you so much for having me.
You begin us in your book, The New Enlightenment, at the Old Enlightenment. You bring us back to 16th century England, you run us up to the 18th century in France, and then at some point we end up in the Soviet Union. What was, let's say, the point of this historical background, if you might just give the listeners a quick overview there?
Well, thanks for the question. First of all, it turns out I always end up in the former Soviet Union, no matter what I do, because my father's side of the family comes from Russia, and I studied Russian and worked, you know, during the Cold War and the end of it, and in and around that part of the world for a long time. Care about it, think about it a lot, and think about it and other places and other times as models, cognates, comparisons for our own day, and so. I remember hearing about, you know, William Tyndall when I was doing a lot of work in the UK, running with a colleague, a BBC alum, something called the Film and Sound Think Tank for a British governmental agency, thinking how to use more film and sound in education. And the anniversary of the King James Bible came up, and it turned out, you know, this guy, William Tyndall, had translated all of it before, you know, King James came around. So I learned a bit more about him. And then in thinking about these travails that you just read part of today, and thank you for, thank you for that. You know, I think back on the punishments that were, you know, administered rather severe ones to people like Tyndall, and then obviously the Encyclopédie in the 1700s is a force very comparable to Wikipedia today.
Yes, and it came out that these punishments that you're talking about, and also the dangers that the philosophes and the Encyclopédie were obviously daily engaged in, because they were speaking blasphemies and trying to bring down the powers that be in their, as you so nicely put it, subtly couched somewhere in their articles. You bring in there the what you call Monsterverse. So the powers against enlightenment, I suppose the dark powers, maybe speaking of the UK, they might just call them the baddies, right?
That's right.
Could you maybe give us your inspiration for this term and this phenomenon?
You know, I can. And I can tell you that, you know, as the father of some children, I spent time watching them absorb, you know, the Lord of the Rings trilogy and Harry Potter and Star Wars. And these are titanic, like, struggles against titanic forces of evil. There is no compromise, you know? And they're mesmerizing. Obviously, they're mesmerizing for children. And I'd like to believe that we prepare our children for fighting the Monsterverse, such as I define it, or such as any of us might define, you know, networks of, you know, evil and baddies, as you put it. Like, maybe we prepare ourselves for these through the fairy tales that we read early on, and especially these intricate stories of battling good versus evil. In my view, the MonsterVerse is everyone through time, across space, who have sought to kind of quash our access to knowledge, such as I believe you think about a lot more than, I have, and well outside of this book. Our access to knowledge, it's the most important thing. It's really the dynamo of human progress, and a lot of bastards out there. Maybe bastards is the word is the word I would use.
Bastiverse.
the
creatures of this MonsterVerse. I wonder if I'm getting inspired here. Sorry.
You're into it.
I am. I wonder if they are not, and this is just more of a philosophical question, so you can skip over it if you like, but I wonder if they're not also the product of lack of enlightenment. Because wouldn't the Enlightenment actually then, spread knowledge all throughout the universe, if we might call it that then? And we would expect, people actually being interested in improving things, advancing knowledge, helping others, and so on. So it would seem that the worst products of a lack of a new Enlightenment or any Enlightenment would be precisely these creatures of the MonsterVerse. Does that sound something that you could buy into?
That does sound good. I have to go back now and revise my text for the next, printing. I think that's brilliant. I do think that the absence of enlightenment produces more people who are support the absence of enlightenment.
Because they must then somehow, they do materially profit from it, or at least imagine they do, I suppose, then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the trick, is to try to figure out what is the evidence that helps people understand that sharing knowledge is better than not sharing knowledge? What are the verifiable pieces of information themselves that we can share with people who don't necessarily believe that it's in society's interest or it's a tricky thing. We're dealing with all kinds of, doubt about science and truth today when it comes to this pandemic we're in. So it's a great question.
The hope that you offer, you bring hope very often into the book, very, very much up front. And I mean, we're in at the moment, and rather dark days. We're in an epidemic. We're at least having a change of regime in America, but I mean, there was an epidemic and a MonsterVerse regime. And you say that is precisely the moment, though, when you can speak about freedoms and improvements. You even cite there Jean-Jacques Rousseau as someone who famously put that it's in the Bastille that you can talk about being free and able to move about as you like. What you bring us, though, is actually a very clear idea of what would need to be done in our new video culture, as you call it. And you can say a word about that in the same breath if you like, too. You bring us a 5-point plan. Perhaps we could touch upon a few of those points, but in run-up to that, what is the video culture? When did we get there?
I have been aware for some time that the majority of efforts by the progressives who support open access or free culture or A2K, access to knowledge, or any number of slogans, shibboleths, and the like, have focused largely on scholarly articles or scientific, technical, medical articles, in some cases books, but almost in all cases text. And it's a weird thing, because I think moving forward, and even now, I think definitely now, the majority of people in the developed world, I guess, get their information from sources other than text, which is not to say sources other than words, and we can go on about that, but, you know, images and sound, radio, television, the web. So I think it's really important that as we think about these struggles, you know, brings me back to the former Soviet Union again, as we think about these struggles, we include in our advocacy work, in fact, we feature the, you know, targeting the future of free and open audiovisual communication over in the Eastern Bloc as the Berlin Wall was coming down, so-called velvet or bloodless revolutions all over those countries and within the former Soviet Union. The main blood that was spilled, like it wasn't entirely bloodless, was spilled around these during these battles for the control of the television towers in places like Moscow and Bucharest and Vilnius. It says something to me.
Yeah, and it's something that comes out very clearly back into the Soviet context of the Samizdat, and as you were calling it then, so a new self-publishing, not the sort of self-publishing that's going on now. And it's very convincing because you see in a culture like that, which had been in the Soviet bloc, where, you know, the merest piece of information can be condemning or is, you know, something that was just what was missing for somebody's universe to come together and to realize, no, this isn't the only reality there is. I mean, every piece of information, we can't tell which ones they will be. It is the fact that they move around freely that matters. And you come to this point here, I can't pronounce the name, unfortunately, but it's Solzhenitsyn, I think. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he spoke of the mystical wisdom of a process in which information that is urgent somehow rises to the top. Samizdat knows what is what. And I just thought that was, I mean, I think it speaks to what you're saying here about the violence to protect, defend, or to attack, you know, a mass communication center within that context of what we're talking about with this information and what knowledge is not surprising, right? I mean,
that's exactly why Tyndall was brought to the stake and strangled at the set on fire and strangled in chapter one. Like that is exactly why, because there's some people who don't want you to know what is what, you know, because if you know what is what, you know what is what, and sometimes what includes, and sometimes what includes, you know, who is who and who is what is when, and, you know, all these other things. So yeah. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, and it's that principle that it needs to be set up as something that's just naturally free. I mean, you say a lot about how information, you make some very interesting comparisons there. Information has its own laws. I mean, there's the well-known phrase here that it wants to be free, but you even bring it into a sort of Newtonian context where it's emotion. It's something that, you know, we can't contain in a way. And that's precisely what's being shown up in the video culture of today or the radio culture of yore, where it's just the fact that it needs to move freely, not necessarily what the information itself is.
That's exactly right. I mean, and part of the connection to the Enlightenment, the original Enlightenment, and what I'm calling for, you know, feebly or strongly, you decide in this readers decide, listeners in this book is, you know, it's motivated by that connection between the old and the new. Newton figured out his laws of motion when he was at home from the university, which had shut because of the plague, by the way. So, you know, who knows what'll come out of this plague that we're in, but Newton figured out that, you know, these are laws of the universe, or at least of Earth, that the apple will fall from the tree, right, because of gravity. And so he charted that and wrote formulas down. And almost exactly at the same time as he was doing that, the first copyright laws were being written also in England and in the early 1700s. And these were laws that were stipulating, like, it was part of the original copyright vision, if you know, it's to be commended for anything. It's this, that the you know, public domain was the ultimate objective of a human intellectual creation. That, you know, I could write something and you could have the license to publish it, and you could sublicense the right for someone else to do an audiobook. By the way, thanks for your reading. I hope that someone, you know, hears it and gets you, you know, boy, would it be nice for you to do the audio version of my book. But, you know, and the licenses go on and on, but when they're all done, or when they should be done, you know, that work goes into like the, you know, the public equivalent of the old grazing commons, where you could take your sheep to eat the grass. Like it's part of society. And, you know, freely accessible. And I just want to accelerate that process a little bit and respect that vision that, you know, Queen Anne's lawyers set about articulating.
Yeah, and that seems to be something that has been forgotten with many of the new copyright laws or intellectual property laws and so on. But what comes up in the book, precisely in this area of, you know, the information ends up in the commons. Its natural trajectory is towards the commons, as you say, at one point. Makes me think of Jonas Salk, the one of polio vaccine fame, who in the 1950s was, in a sense, very much a representative of, you know, biomedical research. And I don't think anyone would think that way today. When he was asked, would he be patenting his discovery? He replies, no, I might as well patent the sun. And to me, that would not be the response today by anyone.
I talk about, in this book, the physics of intellectual property in that light. It's like one of the few, you know, phrases that I've come to like in this volume. And Salk is so relevant today because people have said, if, you know, we didn't have a massive information, disinformation, disorder, whatever, truth decay going on around the vaccine, you know, or if the equivalent kind of, you know, refusals and ignorance had been prevalent during polio, we'd still have polio in this country today. And, you know, a friend of mine in Brooklyn, who's done some work on this, reminds me that, like, polio struck a chord of fear in this nation like nothing else, almost larger than the 1918 influenza epidemic. People were burning their couches in the street after someone had, you know, would visit your house. You'd drag your couch out and set it on fire because you were terrified that you would, you know, contract this fatal or potentially fatal disease. So Salk, it's fascinating to think of Salk in this moment. It's just a great point, and we really should unpack it. We should do 20 more of these, conversations.
Great. Yeah. I do want to get back briefly though to the 5-point plan, where I said, yeah, you get quite specific in the hope that you give, and you say there is a way forward in our video culture. Real quick, the points are to define our rights at the moment, to build new knowledge commons, to construct new networks of facts and evidence. Number 4, to empower the archives at the heart of all knowledge, which is a very good point. And then lastly, where you end off the book, defining our new moment in the process for knowledge institutions to act together. Could you maybe pick up any one of those? I think we've probably said enough about the point of defining our rights and building the commons, but what about maybe the archive? That's a very interesting point there.
You know, it's extraordinary to think how little attention archives get in the modern world. And, you know, in my interactions, for example, with the greatest philanthropies, you know, who support education and who support media, including public media, including online free, you know, open educational resources, how little attention is paid to, you know, where all this stuff is kept and how. And, you know, I go on in the book about the etymology of the word archive and the connection it has to, you know, power in the original Greek, you know, trying to imitate William Tyndale and some of his knowledge of seven languages. You know, I spent time with one Greek word for about a page, but it is a direct connect. Like, who controls the archives controls everything in many ways. You know, the Trump era, you know, his name had to come up. You were kind enough to bring it up for 24 minutes, but the Trump era, you know, will be told largely through historians working with audiovisual communication, because the guy didn't, you know, write a lick, and he communicated via Twitter and on television. All these extraordinary lies are documented there. But what if we don't have access to that? Can we really write the history or produce the history of that 4 years? No. So we have to figure out ways of empowering, protecting the art, and specifically rules around it that allow for not private companies to control, our history, but and our, by extension, our future, but like, all of us, society, to control it. And that's why there's so many interesting things to say about places like the Internet Archive and Wikipedia.
And what I find quite enlightening in that discussion that you give of archives is that you take the example of the Eyes on the Prize, so the documentary about the civil rights movement, and how much work had to be put into sort of deciding points of copyright, because video copyright is just a massively complex and complicated thing. There's so many players involved and so many people who need to be notified. And you say, if I'm getting it right, you say, we need to turn that process on its head. We need to be clear from the beginning. We can really, with very little effort legally, set up a film that would, despite all of that complexity, end up in the commons by a natural course. But it needs to be decided and written down from the beginning that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I've done work a lot of the past, I don't know, 15, 20 years with video. And that's another reason to focus on video, because when we produce some kind of book, like if we do an anthology, you know, we are mired in so many ridiculous entanglements with the 600 years of the way print culture has developed, at the direction often of private interests, that the distance between the ultimate landing place, that commons that is, you know, inherent in Queen Anne's first copyright law, and where stuff, you know, travels immediately after it shoots out of your pen or my pen or, you know, the printing plants do the books that we read. It's a long distance. So, yeah, video is super important, super potentially complicated because of rights we've also allowed to, you know, dominate these discussions in music. Unbelievable in news footage. We should really think about, you know, producing from the get-go these kinds of freely licensable works. And when they're funded also at the beginning, they should be funded with that stipulation, much as, you know, we're finally realizing with scientific research and publishing today, it's critical to be able to share, use, reuse the stuff that, if you're working on genome stuff, or if you're working on, you know, epidemiology. Guess what? Today, super important that we all have access to it.
One of the things that you really uncover is the pattern that occurs when people are trying to bring things to the public, an enlightenment type educational process. You go into the wonderful history of visual education, which I hadn't really even been very familiar with. And you draw up, so from the 1920s to the 1930s, how mass media and democracy play out, and then essentially democracy loses. A wonderful book, which I'm certainly going to be getting my hands on, apparently, by Robert McChesney. Yes, that's the name, Robert McChesney, which tells that story. And then it becomes normalcy that we expect commercials and commercialization of our television or our radio. The 1960s, the Carnegie Commission, where public broadcasting was established. Now I know why it's WGBH. Which I'm thankful to you for. The point that you make there, though, is that we have a recurrent pattern, and it is again and again that we lose to a commercial marketplace. And instead of actually bringing to the public something that would be enlightening.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a problem, but there are ways of drawing inspiration just from the way we can walk around and live. I've talked recently, because of transactions I've witnessed around online education, it's about Central Park in New York, where I grew up. And, you know, Central Park sits, I don't know on how many acres, but it's right there in the heart of New York. That real estate is probably worth, Daniel, I don't know, trillions of dollars. You know what I mean? Like, seriously, it's in the heart of New York. But you know what? People have figured out. They said, we need this park here, and we're not going to let it go. And we're going to find ways of supporting it, keeping it here. And we're not going to sell off this part to developers. Okay, we might put a restaurant in it. Okay. But the entire park stays as it was, like 156, whenever it was, 60 years ago. So I think there are ways of reminding ourselves that when we commit to an idea, you know, our national parks are another example, but I can't speak about them with the same passion as I can about Central Park. Or, you know, when we commit to an idea, we can actually execute on it and keep it and preserve it and develop it and nourish it. So I think we need to revisit, you know, our kind of public domain for the intellect.
Well, Peter, you've been very generous with your time. I do have one last question, which really follows up very closely on your point there about Central Park and committing to an idea. Your book works very much as a call to action. It's time now. You remind us again and again to, you know, to embrace a new enlightenment and then to actually do something for it. It's unfortunately the case, though, now that it seems so easy for very many people to do very little. And I wonder what it is that you could sort of pinpoint or put your finger on as being the real key mover that needs to happen. You know, what is it that's going to actually get people engaged in something like this?
It's a great question. Damn you for asking it. No, it's a great question. I would tie it to that fifth point in that like 5-point agenda that you read out just a moment ago, I guess as part of your previous question. And it would be, you know, to take a broad look. Not everybody will do everything and most people won't do anything, but take a broad look at like our knowledge institutions. Define them as broadly as we can. Like, what is a knowledge? Obviously, a university like the one I work in, but there are museums, there are libraries, there are archives, there are public broadcasting institutions, there are historical societies and other things. And just figure out ways to encourage all of these institutions, which have so many stakeholders, so many members, so many funders, so many visitors and readers and, people who absorb things emanating from these institutions. figure out some way for these all these institutions to kind of publish more, to publish more onto the web. Because as someone put it, it's a quotation that, you know, damn it, came to me after I'd sent this book to press. The truth is paywalled, but the lies are free, kind of thing. And, you know, if these knowledge institutions, such as the one I'm in, can band together, can commit in principle and practice to publishing more, to linking to each other's content, to citing and sourcing each other's work, we'll be a much stronger world, we'll be a much stronger society, and we'll be a little bit better equipped the next time, the baddies, the gladiators from the Monsterverse managed to gain access to the most powerful offices in the land.
Well, thank you very much. That is Peter Kaufman, and his book, The New Enlightenment and the Fight to Free Knowledge, is out with Seven Stories Press. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Peter. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Goodbye, Dan.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.